Fears of Russia's collapse in Biden's and Scholz's administrations run deep and can't be changed by telling stories of Russian war crimes alone, says Jessica Berlin. Advisors and analysts have been conditioned by decades of Soviet nuclear threat and memory of the chaotic and rapid collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. But what can turn politicians that cling to the security blanket of escalation management into leaders that imagine a Ukrainian victory, a triumph of pluralistic democratic values, and help them to plan accordingly? Welcome to the Silicon Curtain podcast. Please like and subscribe and definitely add a comment, as it does help people to discover these videos within the YouTube algorithm. Do please also check out the validated Ukrainian charities. It's incredibly important to make sure that Ukrainian veterans and soldiers are getting the support and equipment that they need. Today, I'm speaking to Jessica Berlin, who is an international political analyst, founder of the strategic consultancy Construct, and vice chairman of the board of directors at the Pan-African fintech company Bridge Technologies. She's previously lived in Afghanistan, China, Myanmar, Rwanda, the UK and US, and worked in security, foreign policy, and economic development. Institutions she's worked with include the US Senate, US Department of Defense, and the German Development Agency. Her commentary has been featured on CNN, BBC, DW News, The Washington Post, Le Monde, and many others. She is currently a non-resident fellow at the think tank SIPA and has held past fellowships from the German Marshall Fund, the Robert Bosch Foundation, and others as well. Jessica, it's an absolute delight to welcome you to the channel. I could probably spend the whole hour listing your accomplishments, but let's jump in.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're going to start, of course, with Ukraine, Russia, and it's been an absolutely momentous week, hasn't it? Ukraine finally is getting the heavy weapons it needs. It's getting a huge tranche of aid from the US, and the UK has followed suit. We must hope that other European countries step up as well, although some, of course, are already doing what needs to happen. But in your mind, what needs to happen next to ensure Ukrainian victory?
Well, as important as the developments in this past week were, and as both on a technical, kinetic level, as well as on a morale level, we have to remember that these wins are really the one step forward after long months of two steps back. So this is aid that could have and should have been coming Ukraine's way a lot sooner. And the fact that this delay has helped the Russians entrench further along the front, make even strategic advances in some places, it just shows how dangerous and how costly our political delays in Western capitals are for Ukraine's fight. That being said, if the politics of this war were strategic, logical, and easy, the war would already be over. So we have to take it as it is and just keep pushing for more of these political wins. And that, in my mind, is the most important thing, of course, on the logistics side right now. And this is the good news about the Americans. When they've made up their minds to do something, they can move quite fast. So there was a lot of equipment already here in Europe that's being, as we speak, moved to Poland and into Ukraine. So we can expect some equipment already to be coming in within days. Other systems will take longer, but the fact is, once Biden signs this into law, things will get moving quite quickly. We need to build on this momentum. Above all, in European capitals, the physics of politics matter, momentum matters. So we need to use this moment to leverage more. And German calls, for example, for the US to donate an additional Patriot system are right on. Quite frankly, Germany could also afford to donate another. The fact that these sort of no-brainer decisions on supporting Ukrainian air defense are taking so long shows just a lack of seriousness, a lack of a sense of urgency amongst our politicians. And unfortunately, the cost for waking them up is Ukrainian lives.
And we've observed, I mean, those who've been observing the conflict at close quarters have seen this drip feed of munitions. And the big debate is whether that has been done strategically, or as you say, whether it is simply the lack of urgency, the lack of seriousness, and the lack of will. The other question is, do Western politicians actually have a strategy for victory? And if they were to get serious about victory, what would need to change?
The short answer is no. No, they do not have a strategy for victory. Very early into this podcast, we're already going to go very meta here. So I think it goes beyond issues of strategy at this point. We have a generation of leaders in office in Western capitals who bought into the myth of the end of history. They were there. They watched. They lived as adults. Victory in the Cold War, or what was thought to be victory, and the normalization of diplomatic and economic relations with Russia, even as Russia in the post-Soviet space, the Russian Federation continued to wage wars and commit crimes and also undermine and conduct espionage against us. So we have a generation of leaders who were directly involved in many of the decisions and mistakes that were made that led us to this point. And I say this without trying to hate on anyone here, because this goes beyond any individual, whether it's a Scholz or a Biden or a Sullivan. This is really systemic. It goes beyond just the individual politicians to the worldview that has prevailed in Western capitals for a generation, has been shown to be completely wrong. And both politically, as well as on a human psychological level, these individuals, these policymakers, these political leaders, I think they are, to an extent, politically and personally, finding themselves unable to admit that they were that wrong for so long. And so that's one side of where I think the lack of a clear vision for victory comes from, because to come out rhetorical guns blazing, calling for victory, and here's how we help Ukraine smash Russia, drive them out, and make sure that they are never able to commit such crimes against another country again. To do that, you would have to then, in the next sentence, in the next inhalation, admit that you helped Russia reach this point. You enabled Russian aggression. This never should have been possible, but for your mistakes. And that is something systemic and pervasive in Western capitals that we need to fight, quite simply, with number one, transparency and accountability. Where these mistakes were made due to ignorance and incompetence, I think that should be handled differently than when it was due to complicity and corruption. But we need to get to the bottom of it and find out who was either blue-eyed and naive with Russia over the years versus who was actually fully aware and enabling and even profiting off of their appeasement and enablement of the Russian regime. The second piece, of course, is, well, this has all been a discussion of Western strategic weakness and historical blindness. We need to listen more to the Central and Eastern and Northern European partners who were getting it right all along. So that is also a very simple way strategically to get more wins in more quickly. Listen to the people who know best. But unfortunately, once again, egos and politics come into play. And there's a great deal of reticence on Western sides to admit they were wrong and that the little countries to the east were right. So this is a major thing we're up against on top of the actual corruption infiltration even of elements of our political establishments and media landscapes. So it's a large systemic issue. And I think at the end of the day, transparency and listening to our Eastern and Northern neighbors are the way to go.
And it does seem that this is an Iron Curtain moment. It's a moment to say there is a force in Russia, and it's not just an individual. There are many, many individuals who do not share the same values as ours and actually have made it their duty to try to tear down and debase those values, create doubt in the minds of people about them. Pluralism, democracy, all the things that actually have generated the sort of wealth and the freedoms that we enjoy. In your view, have we not quite recognized yet that there is a malign force that has set itself against those values, and the Ukraine has very clearly put a stake in the ground? They've aligned themselves with those values. They are fighting for it. They are losing their lives for it. You've been on the ground there all over Ukraine. You've seen that in action. You've seen Ukrainians prepared to die for those things. What's lacking on our side that we don't see the historical importance of this moment and the need to fight for values at this point?
Well, like you say, Ukrainians are fighting for their freedoms, literally dying to be a democracy, to live free. And what we've forgotten is that many people had to fight and die for our countries to enjoy these freedoms, to be democracies. We live free because previous generations sacrificed, fought, died, rationed, let their industries be turned into war industries overnight. You know, you're British, you would have many, many stories also in your family of what the wartime economy and rationing was like, and for civilians, not to mention what it was like for soldiers going to fight. So yeah, there is a deep forgetfulness and complacency of what it took for us, for the current generations, to enjoy the freedoms and the comforts that we have. And unfortunately, history working as it does in a sinusoidal curve, we are now being reminded of the price, and Ukraine is paying most of it. But my hope is, because people like yourself, myself, and many, many colleagues across the Atlantic, we have not forgotten, and we're working night and day to help Ukraine. So we just need to basically stay the course and get the job done.
And there's an interesting discussion I've been observing on Ukrainian media. The Russians be one. Unfortunately, I can't speak Ukrainian, but there is plenty of really good analysis in Russian on Ukrainian media. That does sort of shoot down some of the Russian propagandistic narratives, it has to say. And one of the debating points is that this aid package is fantastic. And there's extreme gratitude to the US and now to the UK as well. And Germany's still in number two spot. I'm always bashing Germany about tourists, etc. But we have to remember that the number two munitions supplier by volume is Germany, UK at number three. But the debate is that this may be the last major aid package coming from the US. Therefore, rather than sitting back and thinking, right, job done, Europe actually needs to step up, double down, and already be taking over the reins of the main supplier to Ukraine to get it from this point of surviving to the point of victory. Is that understood in Europe? And are people preparing for it? I know there are individual voices, certainly, Gavel Hochstadt and others, incredibly vocal about it. But is there a systemic understanding that that is what is now required?
There's an increasing understanding, and that's good news. We've seen, of course, the Czech initiative to buy, what was it, 800,000 rounds of ammunition, of artillery ammunition for Ukraine, sourced from countries around the world who would be uncomfortable selling directly to Ukraine, but are willing to sell to Czech Republic. We've seen the Finns massively increase their domestic production. We we have also even the German defense minister and foreign minister, you know, loudly pushing for more production and support for Ukraine. But the fact of the matter is we need to see our governments not just talking about it, but actually placing orders with industry. Because without orders or guarantees of orders, you can't expect arms companies to produce. Of course not. So, and that has been the case since even before the war began, or the full-scale invasion began. Industry here in Germany was shouting already in January, February 2022 that they had stock ready to sell and were ready also to increase production, and the orders just didn't come. So this the urgency, even after over 2 years of this war of destruction, we're still not seeing the urgency that's needed. The good news here, though, if we can call it that, is it doesn't only rely on us. Our aid is crucial and vital, but it's also not the only thing. Ukraine is drastically increasing their own domestic production capacity, and they're also closing bilateral deals with international producers to produce directly in Ukraine. So these are good, this is good progress to diversify the sources of munitions for Ukraine, and also to create opportunities for investment rather than just donation that can hopefully keep the ammo coming. But the fact that this package took so long has had a dreadful cost along the front lines. The soldiers' units having to ration their ammunition, having to abandon positions because abandon positions that were defensible because they simply had no more ammunition. This is indefensible when you consider what sits in our storage houses across Europe and not to mention across North America.
We have to address that because we've talked about escalation management being one of the driving factors of thinking, unfortunately, both in Washington and Berlin. France and the UK don't seem to quite have the same red lines in their minds, although haven't necessarily, you know, stepped up yet and really gotten to war footing, or the UK tentatively seems to be moving in that direction. Of course, we've had some strong words from Macron as well. But this escalation management seems to be an incredibly divisive, failed strategy. And I saw on X, Twitter, you quoted Bill Kristol with an incredibly interesting quote here, where he says it's perverse to tell a party not to attack the war machine of the aggressor while not delivering military aid to the victim. The administration's pathological fear of escalation and of Ukrainian success is one reason for the death of so many Ukrainians. How do we move beyond this escalation management? And why do you think it's taken such a grip on many decision makers in Washington and Berlin?
The short answer is they've believed Russian threats and they've not understood the psychology of a dictator bully. We have a chancellery and a White House full of people who never stood up to a bully on a playground when they were a child. That really basic human psychology that doesn't change so much from childhood to adulthood, that an aggressor, when they smell fear, they will advance further. If nobody stops them, they'll keep going. But if you stand up to them, they will very quickly back down and run away. And that playground calculus, of course, needs to be extrapolated to a nation state and a nuclear power. But the logic, the pervading logic actually needs to stay the same. What is this nuclear armed state actually capable of in a real fight? And they know it. What are they capable of? What am I capable of? If I show him what I'm capable of, and he knows he's going to lose, he will back down. It's a cost-benefit analysis that that is rational. And because the Russian aggression and so much of what Russia has done appears to the Western perspective to be irrational, I think this fundamental intercultural misunderstanding is part of the problem. There's this very myopic and self-centered sort of self-ethnocentric notion that if the Russians are being strange or irrational according to our rubric, that this means they would also be strange and irrational in other ways, and he'd really nuke Berlin or something if Scholz sends towers to Ukraine. This is, of course, absolutely ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that the Russians have seen that their escalatory threats and rhetoric work. It's a winning strategy for them. It's a very effective communication strategy when they make these threats. It slows down Western aid, and so they keep making them. But you'll notice every time when Western aid has overcome the self-made hurdle of its own fear and political blocking, what have been the consequences? Crickets, nothing. The Kremlin has no clothes. So unfortunately, in Washington and Berlin in particular, this memo has yet to be fully read and processed. But we see, for example, in Paris, the French government and President Macron have become much more proactive, at least in their rhetoric. We have still yet to see them really back that up with a massive military aid package, which we have yet to see and which we are pushing for. But at the end of the day, we have quite simply some weak leaders surrounded by weak advisors who do not understand the psychology and strategy of aggression.
What they also seem to lack, and we were talking about this just before we hit record, is a joined up sense that this isn't just Russian aggression in its local sphere. It's not just Russian aggression trying to recreate the Soviet Union, or at least the sort of triumvirate of Slavic states that it sees as part of its origin story. I mean, that is certainly a feature of the war. Russia is pushing on every front and throughout the world, using information, extraction resources, mercenaries, etc. You've recently written a fantastic paper, or you were cooperating in the creation of one, about the activities of Wagner in Africa. And of course, we usually focus on Wagner and the sort of theatrics of that organization, but it also has a strategic purpose, doesn't it? Which is stripping assets, stripping metals, stripping resources to fund Putin's global ambitions. Could you give us a bit of an overview of your thinking about how we fail to confront Russia's global strategy?
Absolutely. Well, as we all know, Wagner Group grew out of the 2014 invasion of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. And as a mercenary group, but to your questions about Wagner's operations in Africa, on the African continent, Russia has, through the Wagner Group, since about 2017, 2018, been offering not only mercenary services, so security services, fighters, also trainers, military trainers to regimes and warlords. They have also been offering disinformation campaigns, packages to attack political rivals and spread disinformation that's favorable to their clients, much along the model that Wagner, of course, employed in many Western European and of course, the U.S. election, whether in the Clinton-Trump campaign or the Brexit referendum, as we famously saw this toolbox of, on the one hand, helping regimes attack their opponents, shut down the opposition, intimidate journalists and opposition politicians and whistleblowers, spread disinformation among the populace, and then backing that up on top with mercenaries, with brute force. This is what basically Wagner is selling. And in the case of the report you mentioned, which I co-authored, the Blood Gold Report, this was an investigation that we conducted last year, and it was focused on Russian operations in Central African Republic, Mali, and Sudan, where Wagner Group has basically been extracting directly or indirectly gold from these countries, or in the case of Mali, gold revenues via the taxes being paid to the Malian junta from Western gold mining companies in the form of taxes, and then those taxes being used to basically pay Wagner Group for their security services, that they've established a very successful business model, a business model that brings them billions in revenue, with which they can, of course, finance the Kremlin's war coffers. But also, and more importantly, it embeds them into the power structures of these countries. And they have been spreading Russian influence, propaganda, economic and military ties across the Sahel and in West Africa. And to great effect, we've been seeing Western governments and diplomatic presences be pushed out of Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, of course, over the past months. And this is going to continue. Russia has seen that the Sahel in particular and Africa in general is for them a growth market. There's a market for what they're offering. They're able to spread it pretty easily, quite simply because, amongst other reasons, the Americans and the Europeans are not really trying to counter it. I have not seen a discernible strategy yet from a single Western partner trying to combat Wagner's influence across the continent in a comprehensive strategic way. So this is something that we also need to understand. Wagner's leverage, or now they're calling themselves, of course, Africa Corps, and are under the control of the Russian Ministry of Defense since the Prigozhin mutiny and execution. But in any case, we have a situation where Russia will now have a variety of regimes basically in their back pocket whose own security now relies on Russian goodwill. Russia will be able to influence these governments. They'll be spreading their influence, and the instability and insecurity that they create will also indirectly be able to increase the sense, and I say the sense in Europe, and the fear of migration coming from Africa. And this, of course, feeds into the narratives of Russia's allies in the right-wing nationalist and xenophobic parties in Europe, who love to wield the scepter of immigration and refugees to win domestic political points and stoke up fear and xenophobic worries in our populations. So it's part of a comprehensive strategy where Russia has seen that, once again, They've tested, iterated, and seen, oh, this works. When I threaten, when I threaten the West with a nuclear strike, even a nuclear strike on Ukraine, it slows down Washington and Berlin. So I'm going to keep saying that. Oh, when I insert myself in a conflict in the Sahel, I'm able to generate business opportunities for myself. I'm able to increase my political power and leverage. And there's no downside yet for me. So I'm going to keep going. Why shouldn't they? It's a growth market for them, put in very banal terms. So we need to basically wake up We live in a global economy. We live in a global world. And even if most American European legislators couldn't find Central African Republic on a map, they better get an atlas and check it out, because this matters. And right now, we see consolidation even of the Russia-aligned West African and Central African states. They'll basically be able, if given time and further resources from Russia, they'll be able to present themselves as a bloc and an alternative to the democratic unions on the continent, like ECOWAS. Of course, we've seen the withdrawal from ECOWAS of the Russian-aligned states. They can also be threatening the EAC through other means. And this is it's a truly it's the beginning of what could be a very, very dangerous trend in Africa if we don't listen to and start working with our democratic allies across the continent, start listening to their concerns and actually helping them fight this threat. Because at the current moment, Wagner sees Africa as open season.
And this is the interesting part, isn't it? Is that, you know, a lot of the commentary, and I can see a lot of the commentary on this video, is going to be, oh, what's a British guy doing talking about imperialism, talking about colonialism? I mean, don't you guys, you know, have any sense of history? Well, actually, I'm part Irish, so yes, I do have a very keen sense of history. Okay. And I studied in Scotland. So again, you know, that gives a certain amount of understanding of how this stuff works. Russia essentially is an extraction autocracy. It's not just projecting power around the world. It seems to be trying to reproduce the business environment where its style of informal relations, lack of legal basis, coercion, force, and an extraction vertical, extracting dictatorship. It's trying to reproduce the circumstances where it can do business and push out the Western model based on legality. Now, this is bad for Africa, surely, because what history seems to show is that where you have pluralism, where you have civil society, where you have institutions, you have the creation of wealth, you have the distribution of wealth throughout the population, you have growing innovation, and you have an increase in the sum total of happiness. People might find that idea trite, but I think it can be demonstrated quite conclusively. Russia is not just pushing its power in terms of a global politics, it's pushing an extremely destructive and divisive business model that destroys innovation. What, in your view, should we be doing to counter that and to start to believe again in the values that have actually brought us so many benefits?
Yes. Well, of course, the irony of Westerners complaining about Russian or Chinese, for that matter, influence in Africa is there. My answer to that, and especially when I talk to Western politicians about this issue, my answer is pretty unpopular. And that is that the African governments and African people across the continent have every right to be deeply skeptical and even derisive towards our speeches and statements on this issue. And that's why action is the only thing that matters. Where are the trade agreements with African economies? Where is the access? I mean, we supposedly love the free market so much, but we make it incredibly expensive, effectively impossible for African countries to trade with us in agriculture, for example. Because here in Europe, because our agricultural industries are so deeply, deeply protected, you know. So if we talk about poverty reduction and letting the market grow and spread prosperity and institutional reforms and education across the land, you know, all this sweeping narrative of how we somehow modernized and have enjoyed 15 minutes of peace and prosperity in Europe, we're not applying the same logic to Africa. So it's a deep, deep hypocrisy. And the only way to combat it is to fix it. And this means actually listening to African governments and civil society when they tell us what we're doing isn't working and this is what we need. Also to invest with seriousness. Before the full-scale invasion, for years, my primary work was African-European business partnerships, specifically in the tech space. So technology for development, like med tech, ed tech, ag tech, technologies and business models that that also solve, problems in the lives of the user. And I saw so much hypocrisy and post-colonial hangover coming from the Western side. We expect speeches to transform economies rather than investment. And that's nonsense. So to be fair, a lot of Africans have every right to be skeptical and roll their eyes. But the truth is we need to put our money and our mouth where our morals are, whether that's in Ukraine or in Sudan, until we do, no one's going to believe us because we've spent hundreds of years committing the same kinds of crimes that Russia is now committing in Ukraine. And we may think, oh, but look, we've been civilized now for a few decades. So bygones, guys, get over it. We did. No. Historical memories are long. And we need to show that we're serious.
And the challenge, of course, is that Russia is not necessarily seen as a colonial power. A lot of its propaganda narratives are built around the idea of giving it some kind of sort of moral status, which, in my view, it doesn't deserve. But its behavior exhibits some of the most rapacious and toxic characteristics of European imperialism. Is it now the time for us to designate Russia a terrorist state? Why has that not happened universally in the US, UK? I know Europe has made some strides towards that. Is it because it places certain responsibilities and obligations if we were to start enshrining that status of terrorist state into law?
In a word, yes, exactly. The consequences of designating Russia a terrorist state would also impact our own economies and businesses. And so in a lot of Western capitals, there's no appetite to do this. Yeah, designating Russia a terrorist state would also impact our companies and economies. So there's a lack of political will to do this. There's pushback from the financial sectors. And this just goes back again to the question of what will it take for our leaders to recognize what it takes to win? Do we want victory or not? What is it worth to us? If the bottom lines of some corporations are more important to us than hitting Russia where it hurts, that's on us. Russia has fulfilled every necessary legal definition and distinction of a terrorist state. The only reason this hasn't happened is the lack of political will and profiteering self-interest on our side. This is where we're at. The good news is history often moves this way. We get it wrong. We're slow. Entrenched political interests will have their say. Things will have to get worse before they get better. But even just going beyond the issue of declaring Russia a terrorist state, just to take another example, why are Russian tourists still allowed in the European Union and the United States? It's mind-boggling. This is absolutely a deterrent and a punishment that should be used. Well, it's a diplomatic weapon that we have that should have been used long ago. There should be no acceptance of Russian visa applications to enter the democratic community of states unless they're applying for asylum. They should need to apply, and there needs to be really clear reasons of asylum or family emergency reasons to allow any citizen of the Russian Federation to enter our states. Absolutely. Russia is waging war against us.
Absolutely.
Waging war against us. And it's like we've just closed our eyes and said, okay, as long as we don't see it, then it can't be true.
Well, my grandparents were interred on the Isle of Wight, fleeing Nazi Germany, until it could be demonstrated conclusively that they were not spies or enemy agents. Yes, people just fail to sort of see the moment, see that we are close to that point. Now, the very, very last question, because you've been incredibly generous with your time, and I know you've got a ton of stuff to do, but the very last question, I think, is an important one. Do we need to stop worrying about Russia losing the war? And do we need to stop worrying about what happens to Russia when it has lost the war? Because we can hardly influence that process.
Absolutely. And Timothy Snyder has answered this question so many times, a million times better than I ever could. I'll paraphrase things that he's shared and stated over the years. It is a good thing for imperial powers to lose wars. And the only reason that Europe has become the European Union and this union of democratic states is because the imperial powers of Europe lost imperial wars. This taught us, whether it was Britain, whether it was Spain, whether it was Germany in World War II, France and Algeria, we learned through failure, through defeat, through military defeat, we learned that it's not good to be bad. It's not in our self-interest. We are hurting ourselves. We are losing resources, money, and power by trying to be an imperial power. We were disincentivized from having empires. The sort of narrative that we all woke up after World War II and suddenly we're democratic, human rights loving societies is simply not true. And the losses of our imperial wars are what enabled us to become the European Union. And this does not mean that if Russia loses in Ukraine, they will suddenly wake up and become democratic and freedom loving. No, not at all. But to put it the other way, for Russia to win this war would mean that they learned that this kind of war has benefits. This is a good thing to do. If they win in Ukraine, they will not stop. That is guaranteed. And why should they? They will have learned that this brings them a net benefit. They have to lose in Ukraine, not only for the millions of obvious reasons for Ukrainian sovereignty and lives and freedom, but if we want to look at just as a pure geopolitical calculus focused on Russia, Russia needs to lose because they need to learn that they can never do this again. They need to be deterred from ever trying to gain an inch of territory beyond the Russian Federation borders. And this is a lesson, unfortunately, that can only be taught with force, because we've already let them go too far. They destroyed Chechnya. No downside for them. They invade Georgia. No downside for them. They bombed the shit out of Syria. No downside for them. They invade Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. Again, where is the consequence? Business continued as usual. If this escalation, if this invasion is not met and stopped with brute force, rest assured, they will continue. And they've already loudly stated that their next targets are in the Baltics. So we need to wake up and actually listen to what the Russians themselves are saying, as well as look at the patterns of history and the psychology and strategy of aggression, and understand that it's on us we need to stop them. We've already given them too much time. Too many lives have been lost, but this is far from over. And we can use the momentum of this moment, the passage of the American and British aid bills, the German Patriot decision. We need to build on these wins of the past weeks and do more and send Ukraine into the spring and summer fighting season with the arms and the political backing they need to win.
Absolutely. And people may not be aware that Russian propagandists are making threats against Kazakhstan. They're making threats against Uzbekistan, against Georgia, Armenia. It never ends, it seems, the threats and coercive behavior. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on the channel. It's been an absolute delight speaking to you. Incredibly insightful as well. And of course, everyone who isn't following you, I strongly advise they should. Your opinions are forceful, incredibly well-informed, and pretty much on the nose every single time. Thank you so much for joining the channel and sharing that with us, and for everything you do for Ukraine.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.